listening to Scopes Monkey Choir.
We're on? Are we on Scopes Monkey Choir?
We are on.
Is it episode 82?
It is.
Am I full of questions today?
You are. Is your name Hai Ting?
My name is Hai Ting. Is your name Matthew?
Yes. Scopes Monkey Choir, the podcast for music and sound.
Well,
meets
bye.
Science.
Thanks for listening.
Excuse me. I'm podcasting here.
Well, my questions are answered.
Episode 82. And we got four things we're covering. So let's hop right in.
Go at a faster tempo and not be boring.
Yeah.
Ha! Okay, so first of all, we have this nice little news item that it was sent in, or put rather posted on our Facebook page. We have a Facebook page.
We had totally forgotten.
We had a Facebook page. But a nice listener named Michael posted this on our Facebook page. This is about aurora sounds in Finland. And this is something that's not exactly maybe in our... Well, I guess it's in our purview. But this is the sort of thing that maybe Brian Dunning would like to talk about at some point. Because we don't know the folk tales and things that might be referred to in this. Apparently, people over the ages have reported hearing sounds with the aurora borealis of various kinds, but I have not looked into the folk tales.
Right.
This particular thing is some scientists up in Finland who actually recorded some sounds associated with the aurora borealis. Now, over the years, when people said that they heard sounds associated with the aurora borealis, scientists said that's impossible. If they are making any actual sonic sounds, they are much too far away for humans to perceive them, and what you're hearing must be blah blah blah, trees, an illusion, lightning,
which
something.
Sort of makes sense, because they're so far up that if they made a sound loud enough to be heard on the ground, you'd hear them all the time, because they would be so loud people would hear them.
You could basically look at the aurora and hear it, right? So it would be not a question.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so this in this case, what has happened... Oh, wait, I should first say that the aurora are long and well associated with radio waves that they produce. Mm. And that lots of people... it's quite common and it's long been known. In fact, I think the first radio waves caused by the same phenomenon as the aurora were picked up by the first telegraph operators, and they did not know what they were. There's a great little story from a sound artist on All Things Considered who talks about the history of this and plays some of the radio sounds. Basically, if you have a radio, you can pick up the radio waves caused by the aurora borealis,
which
are kind of beautiful and musical. Yeah, but those are not sound waves. Those are radio waves.
And then you have a radio, which translates radio signals
into sound. Right. Exactly. So that is not what we are talking about. That is a well-established scientific phenomenon. This is the idea that the aurora are somehow producing or associated with some kind of sound waves, that is a disturbance in the air. So what these researchers in Finland at the University of Aalto. Is that how it's pronounced?
It has two A's.
It could be Aalto or something like that. Please forgive me in Finland for the dreadful mispronunciation of this university.
We've had listeners in Finland.
Yeah, and if our listeners in Finland know more about these myths of... Perhaps I should say reports of aurora sounds, please call the monkey phone and let us know about it. We'd be very interested, or write into us.
Yes.
So these researchers have recorded some sounds that they have triangulated using several microphones, and these are kind of clapping sounds. We will post a link to a sound that they recorded in 2007 when they were doing some other
research. I can play it now.
Research. Yeah, well, why don't you go ahead?
I'll play it right now. Yeah.
So at the time, they were not looking for these sounds, and they very carefully say that this sound that you just heard is a recording from 2007, and they cannot conclude anything from that particular recording. But then they set up an array of microphones, partially to try to figure out what this was and where it was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And they reported over the summer at this conference that we really should have gone to. It was the 19th International Congress on Sound and Vibration in Vilnius, Lithuania.
Hmm.
And where 693 papers on sound and vibration were presented.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Amongst them was this paper that they presented on these sounds, which they triangulated to 70 meters above the ground.
70 meters.
So too high to be trees. Too high to be Bigfoot. Well, we don't know about that.
That's true.
Bigfoot could have wings. Too high to be trees, but otherwise inconclusive. And all they are saying right now is that's where the sounds were coming from.
So they recorded, they've actually recorded a sound. They don't know what it is. It seems to be correlated. They seem to have correlated it possibly with the aurora,
yes.
But they're not claiming to have. They're continuing to study it to see if they can figure out either A, what it actually is, or B, if it could possibly be somehow actually caused by the aurora.
Right. They know
right.
Nothing.
So like Bigfoot is flying with his jetpack, and when there's aurora, it interferes with his jetpack, and he goes, ah! And that's the sound of him screaming as he falls and plummets and dies.
Right, except that we have a recording of the sound, but we have no picture of Bigfoot. So they are not looking for Bigfoot. They are trying to figure out what's making this
so
sound.
So no Bigfoot. All right, so basically this is a to be continued. This is,
it is
scientists offering a paper saying, here's what we're working on.
Yes, and also basically saying, if you heard this sound, then perhaps it is something to actually look into as something possibly made by the aurora.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you heard something more like Bigfoot on a jetpack, we do not have a recording of Bigfoot on a jetpack, and we are not giving you any credence on that one. I mean, I think it's an interesting skeptical moment because, partially, we don't know what the folklore is.
Well, yeah, but let's just assume that there's some folklore of aurora making sound. Scientists have always poo-pooed it, and now there's a group of scientists saying, wait, maybe we should look into this, so now they're looking into it.
Because we actually recorded something. It's
right.
As though somebody got an actual video of a Bigfoot, like they did when somebody dressed up in a Bigfoot costume, and then they looked into it, and they discovered that it was a hoax. So who knows, they might discover that it was a hoax, but in any case, they have
it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. It would be totally fascinating if it was actually caused somehow by the aurora.
Especially since no one can figure out so far a plausible mechanism for what is making that sound. They have no idea.
Well, yeah, I don't know. That sounds pretty generic to me. But anyway,
well,
what do I know?
Pretty generic, but it's also being made 70 meters above the ground.
Right, right.
So what else do we have?
I wanted to briefly mention this 70%, this music piracy thing. There was the RIAA, the Record Industry Association of America, which is most famous these days for being obnoxious and suing people for downloading songs and such. Or I should say, you know, they claim to be protecting artists' rights and everything, but they're just all ham-fisted. And anyway, I'm all right, trying to be neutral here. someone leaked a slide from an internal RIAA presentation. They had hired a market research firm called the NPD Group to do a study, just a sort of overview of how people get music, which they imply actually that they do every year. So anyway, someone actually leaked a slide from their presentation on it. And it had some very interesting revelations. Now, I want to say up front, this is based data from a study of a market research firm. This isn't peer-reviewed or anything like that. But it's interesting because it comes from within the belly of the beast, so to speak. So in any case, here's what the slide said. 35%, this is in 2011, 35% of music was acquired legally. So that is CD sales, iTunes downloads, etc.
It's not very high.
It is not very high. However, it is actually up from the previous year. That is up 3%.
Wow.
And it's up even beyond that. The peak of illegal acquisition of music was in 2006, and legal acquisition has been on the increase since then. So one of the main interesting things in this slide, though, is that only of the illegally obtained music, only 15% is from internet downloads, i.e., peer-to-peer swapping and such. So, in other words, the thing that gets yelled and talked about all the time is how the internet is destroying the music industry, and how, you know, all teenagers must be taken to court, basically, and thrown in jail because of the illegal swapping of music online. And it turns out, according to the RIAA itself, that it's only about 15% in 2011. And, in fact, that is down 6% from the previous year and has continued to go down in the past couple of years.
So not officially from the RIAA itself, but rather leaked from an internal presentation.
Well, from what is apparently their data.
What is apparently their data.
Yeah. So it's just, I found it interesting. Now, what this means is that of the illegally acquired music, that the majority of it is from swapped hard drives and burning and ripping of other people's collections, either from hard drives or CDs or MP3s or whatever. In other words, offline.
You mean people making mixtapes like they've been doing for 50 years.
Exactly.
Or 60 or 80 years.
So I just thought that was very interesting, that it was just this actually online stealing of music, as it were, is really a small percentage of music acquisition.
Well, the RIAA better come into our homes and make sure that we're not ripping our CDs
I'm sure they would if they could. So I just wanted to mention that. I thought it was interesting. And there you go. There I am using my larynx. Am I using my larynx?
Are you using your larynx?
Me?
Your larynx. You're using your larynx. You're powering your larynx from your lungs and causing your vocal folds to freely vibrate like the reed of an oboe or like, yeah, the way we've talked about voices functioning, just like an elephant. No.
Not
unfortunately.
Right.
Okay, so everyone knows about this already, the elephant larynx. Some biologists, in conjunction with some voice scientists, some human voice scientists, got their hands on an elephant larynx.
Right.
From a zoo in Berlin, where an elephant died of natural causes, and the larynx was frozen and taken to a lab in Austria, where these biologists did some work with it. And the point of the work was to further discover how elephants make the infrasonic sounds that they use to communicate over long distances.
Right. Now, these are the extremely low and generally too low for humans to hear sounds that elephants make and can actually travel through the ground long distances.
Yes.
And that's one of the ways that elephants communicate over...
And it was only discovered recently because... Right. The fundamental of these sounds is too low for us to hear, generally between 15 and 20 hertz.
Right.
Do you want to play that the sound of the elephants doing this in the wild?
Sure. So clearly, though, that's not a sound that humans can't hear because we can hear
right, we are hearing it. Now, what we are hearing, and this is very cool, is the overtones, because we cannot hear the fundamental, but we can hear the approximately 40 and 80 hertz overtones.
Right. See our episode on the harmonic series.
Yeah. So when it is loud enough, we can hear that.
Cool.
Okay. Now, as you may notice, this is not the sound of elephants trumpeting. And part something that makes me a little sad about this paper is that they're not studying the trumpeting of elephants, and in fact, it still remains a huge mystery. How elephants make that trumpeting sound, they don't even know whether it's produced in the larynx or the trunk.
Right, right. It certainly sounds like it's in the trunk. But no, that's one of the things that is pointed out with this study and this work that they're doing, is that even though we now have laryngoscopes, which is where you basically stick a camera down the throat to look at the larynx, you can't do that with an elephant. That's
because
making a sound.
Elephants are dangerous. And
yeah, because
like
if you try to stick something down an elephant's trunk or in its larynx, it's going to step on you. And rightfully so.
Or pick you up with its trunk.
Yeah.
So what they were trying to discover, this was the mystery. They felt pretty sure that that sound was somehow being made in the elephant's larynx with its vocal folds, because they know that elephants have vocal folds that are pretty much like ours, just a lot bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But there are two possible mechanisms for making sounds with vocal folds, and they happen across mammals of, as they said, four orders of magnitude. So from the very smallest little rodents and bats and things, all the way up now through elephants, they have vocal folds, and there are two mechanisms by which animals can make sounds with their vocal folds. One is like we do. And what we do is we separate the vocal folds. You can also listen to our episode on vocal function. But basically, we separate the vocal folds to breathe in, and then we bring the vocal folds together, and we breathe out. We send the air out of our lungs, and the air going past those vocal folds, which are touching each other, causes them to freely vibrate, as I said, like the double reed of an oboe.
Right.
So the air pressure... alternately causes the vocal folds to open and then shut. And
right.
The pressure of the air rushing past the open vocal folds causes them to come back together.
This is how we make all our vocal sounds that have pitch and such. And the important thing to point out is that with this method, the power source is actually your lungs. You're pushing air out of your lungs, so the muscle power is from the bottom of your lungs.
But your vocal folds are not, in fact, using any muscles. It's just because of the texture of the vocal folds that they vibrate like this when air is pushed past them.
Right.
So there is another mechanism by which mammals can use their larynx to make sound, and that is the cat's purr. And there are a few mammals that can purr, including all the felines and then also genets, which are weasels. I don't know if other weasels can purr. And it's the only other one I can remember off the top of my head. There are a few.
Right.
And what they are doing when they are purring, they are still using their larynx and they are, in fact, still using their lungs. There is some air going through the vocal folds. But each pulse of the purr is a muscular approximation, by which I mean a bringing together of the vocal folds. So they're deliberately bringing together their vocal folds on each one of those vibrations.
Right.
Yes,
basically
they're
slapping them together, basically.
Yes, yes, but it's basically like this. It's as though I was using my lips to be vocal folds.
Right.
So as you can hear, it's not very loud.
Right.
And purring, as we know, is not very loud, because of the relative power of those two different modes of vibration. And that purring requires a neural impulse, a neuromuscular impulse on each one of those pulses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like a deliberately doing it. A side note on that, animals that vocalize with their vocal cords, that might have been redundant. Animals that vocalize, there's generally a correlation between the size of the animal and the pitch of the fundamental range that they can make. So the smaller
makes
the
sense.
Animal, the higher and squeakier the sound. Right. But the purr breaks that correlation.
Oh.
That's how an animal as small as a cat or a genet can make a really low pitched sound.
Nice.
So that has a very low frequency.
Right.
Basically, you can hear the frequency of the purr. It's each So the question was whether the elephants making these infrasonic sounds were purring or singing,
right?
Basically, or vocalizing like us.
So the way I understood it, they actually took the larynx and they set it up in their lab and actually pushed air through it, right? And
yeah, they warmed and humidified some air to recreate what it would be like in the elephant's lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And they mounted the larynx on the end of a tube that's like the elephant's throat. And they pushed the warm, humidified air through the vocal folds, which they put in the position, the together position. They approximated them.
And they heard the sound.
Basically, they got them to vibrate at about 16 hertz by pushing air past them, which doesn't prove that elephants don't purr, but they got such a sound, they got a sound that is really close to that infrasonic
right.
sound
so
that elephants make in the wild.
It makes it very, very likely that the infrasonic sounds that we're talking about are made in this fashion, but it does not, it actually doesn't say anything about whether or not they also can purr.
Yeah.
Oh, and, a spider on my leg.
Oh, a spider on your leg.
Whoa.
Oh.
Spider.
A big one?
No, let's not talk about it. He's
okay,
gone now.
Okay, then.
No, he's run off.
All right.
Yeah.
So, elephant's purring. Elephant.
Yeah.
No, elephant's not purring. The other reason that makes them think that these sounds are not purring is because they are incredibly loud.
Right.
And they do not think that a purr could be that loud, just because that's how these things work. The bringing together deliberately with a neural impulse does not create as loud a sound as the power that you can get from the full-on force of the lungs going past closed vocal cords. There's a great interview with Christian Herbst, one of the scientists on this project, on the Science Magazine podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're at all interested, I suggest you listen to it. It was a couple episodes ago, and he's very interesting to listen to.
And we will also put on our show page a link to the... you can look at a little video of an elephant larynx having warm humidified air pushed through it.
And vibrating at 16 hertz, which means 16 times per second.
So what about elephant pop music?
Oh,
is it as good as it used to be?
I hear it's really boring.
Yeah. Well, that's too bad. So I'm gonna, all right, look, we get these like music science news alerts from, you know, news services and such. And pretty much every alert that I get now is just this story about how science has, this is in quotes, science has proved that modern pop music is louder and dumber.
Speaking of louder and dumber, shouldn't that be proven?
Proven. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm dumb and loud.
No,
so
you're neither.
I'm assuming that everyone listening has probably heard about this already, because it's everywhere. But the basic thing is, the angle we're going to take is that most news outlets are over-reporting this. What a surprise. So let's talk about exactly what the study does say, and then about what it doesn't say. This is a Spanish team of researchers that did some analysis using the Million Song dataset, which we've mentioned before, that when we talked about whether modern music has more modern minor keys and such. Remember
whether
we talked about
sadder,
that?
Whether it's sadder, yes.
This is also that study was also based on the Million Song dataset.
Sadder and more ambiguous, those were
yes.
the terms, yes.
now, the Million Song dataset, by the way, is publicly available. So you too can go, and we'll link to it. You can go and you can download their 280 gigabyte dataset.
And you can spend the rest of your life listening to those million songs.
Well, not listening, but examining the data about those songs.
Oh, they don't even have the songs?
No, it's just a data regarding
because that
songs.
Would be stealing.
Right, exactly. That would be 280 gigabytes of, yeah. So, the Spanish team, they looked at 464,411 songs that came out between 1955 and 2010. They looked at the timbre, which is basically sound, color, texture, or tone quality. They looked at pitch, which in one of the researchers' own words, what they were looking at roughly corresponds to the harmonic content of the piece, including its chords, melody, and tonal arrangements. And they looked at loudness. So what they found basically is a decrease in the diversity of chords in a given song, and also a decrease in the number of novel transitions. So maybe it used to be like a pop song commonly has just like four chords in it. Now, maybe in the 60s, it was more common for, maybe it only had four chords, but one of those chords might not be one of the standard chords you hear in every rock song, for instance.
It might be a flat two chord.
Yeah, for instance. You can get technical on the audience. So and then they also found that loudness is increasing.
Wait, will you explain that to me?
What
does that mean? Can you just turn down the volume?
Right. It's not the same thing as like the loudness of, you know, you can choose how loud the sound is that you're listening to. But the actual inherent loudness of a recording is something that has been changing. In fact, it's been going increasing by about 1 decibel every 8 years. Now, the reason this is that you can, the more you compress the sound, the sort of overall, the overall volume in a recording can actually be louder. So the easiest way to think about this is that whenever you do this, it's at the expense of the dynamic range of the recording. So for instance, you can have a very soft sound, and then you can have a very loud sound, and then you can compress those things. You can compress the loud sound, and you can increase the volume of the soft sound. And the more and more you do that, the overall volume of the song is going to slowly increase. Now, this has been happening for years and years, and part of the reason is just because everyone wants their song to stand out, because it's this human thing that if something is slightly louder than what came before it, your ear automatically notices it more.
Like the commercials on TV.
Exactly, like the commercials on TV.
They're always louder.
They're going to pop out, and that's what they're trying to get your attention, because if something is suddenly louder, it gets your attention, because we are apes. More on that later. So that's increased that. You know what? I'm going to link to, there's a very good YouTube video, just like 2 minutes, that gives a very good explanation of the loudness wars, as they are called. So what I really want to get to is just the criticisms. Both Slate.com and Scientific American had some good sort of skeptical take on this study, because it's limited. Basically, I didn't find anyone sort of directly arguing with their conclusions, but that, all right, well, I'll say the things, the problems. Now, one of the problems is that the contents of the data set, the million song data set, is actually, it's actually quite weighted to modern music. So for instance, the database from 1955 to 1959, the database has only 2,650 songs. Whereas from 2005 to 2009, it has 177,808 songs.
Good Lord. So could we conclude from this that there's simply more pop music now than there used to be?
Well, there is certainly more digitized. And I'm just making this up, but I would think there's just more. I mean, for instance, now, you know, any schlub like me, I can record an album and make it digitally available,
right,
for sale. You know, everyone, you used to have to sort of fight to get signed by a label like that. You know, that whole thing is not
working. So probably there is a lot more pop music than there used to be.
Yeah. But that also, it also is a result of what's currently popular, and also what oldies have been digitized.
Because only the good oldies have been digitized.
So,
and the really bad oldies.
You know, there's the old idea that like, oh, all information is on the internet. And it's not actually true. Of course, there are a lot of songs from the past that have not been digitized. Or, you know, maybe they did get initially released on CD, but they didn't get repressed and aren't on iTunes or blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. So, and then there's the test of time problem. The filter of the test of time. So in the test of time, the less bland songs are going to survive better, and also the prime examples. Like you'll have a type of song, a type of sound that's popular for a while, and as time goes by, only really the prime examples of that fad are going to really survive.
But those are only going to be one or two songs, and therefore they're not going to have as much weight in these statistics.
Right. So this is one of the criticisms. Now, one of the researchers did argue against this criticism, and he argues that actually when you look at shorter time periods within the data set, that the same trends hold true. So for instance, if you look at, I'm making this up, but if you look at the data from 2003 to 2006, the trends that they see overall over the decades, you also see in those smaller sets. So they're basically saying, so it's reasonable to assume that such trends are true.
So basically what we can say is that pop music is louder and dumber than it was last year.
Right, exactly. Which, you know, so, you know, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. I'm not a statistician. I can't really comment on it.
Everything's going to hell.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then another criticism that was pointed out is that it didn't take into account anything about rhythm, about rhythmic complexity. And so, for instance, like the way I think about this is, you know, people often say like a really good guitarist can play like two notes and make you cry, you know, and it's, which is probably not true, but the idea just
they
being
they played them
that,
for long enough, I would cry.
Yes, for instance, said the woman who sings Philip Glass all the time. So you take, you know, guitarists will take these two notes and go back and forth in this and vary their, vary the dynamic and the rhythmic thing in a way that it's going to touch you, right? So such a solo, for instance, if there were such a guitar solo that was really moving, would not show up as being interesting the way that they examined the data.
Statistically interesting.
Right. So you see what I mean?
And we're also talking here about things like rap, where there might only be one chord in the entire song, but it's all about the words.
Right. And yeah, that's regular listeners will know that that's one of my broken records. That's one of my pet peeves about these kinds of studies is that pop music in the past couple of decades has seen the rise of, or the decline, I should say, the decline of chordally based music. You know, the decline of pop songs that are sort of based on chord changes in a sort of traditional sense. Hip hop is just not like that. It has an entirely different approach to harmony because it uses samples mainly and such. So
this is something that they should control for if they're going
right.
to follow up
on this. A really rigorous examination would have to control for that in some fashion. I don't know how the hell you do that.
You take out the rap and you just do like guitar pop through the ages,
yeah, okay. Yeah,
like
that would be interesting. Yeah, that would be interesting. So these are other people's and our criticisms of what is actually a really interesting study. The study, by the way, is the full study is freely available for reading. And you can take a look yourself. We'll link to it.
The loudness is the only one that's not in question, isn't it? It's been getting louder.
Yeah.
Inherently louder.
No, what's interesting, though, is that everyone's been saying that for years, but this appears to be the first time anyone's actually empirically shown it.
Mm.
But no one's surprised by that. The loudness war is pretty.
So
well
basically, we're losing all the soft volume in pop music.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what you were saying.
Exactly, the dynamic. And this stands out. If you ever say on, I don't know, put iTunes on random, or you know, have a CD player, multi CD thing on random. If you mix up a classical music CD with a current pop music CD, it's striking. Because classical music has, in general, there are exceptions, but in general has not been taking part in the loudness wars.
Because it's all about dynamic
exactly,
contrast.
Exactly. The extreme dynamic contrast is one of the hallmarks of classical music. And so, as a result, classical music CDs just literally sound quieter than pop music CDs. I mean, and even the loudest parts of classical music CDs sound quieter because of this, the ultra compression, which pop music has been doing more and more of for years, but classical hasn't.
We better get some elephants in there to make loud noises.
I can't do elephant. Can you do an elephant sound? Thank you for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir.
From scopesmonkeychoir.com.
We are professional musicians, not scientists. If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us. Look it up yourself.
Nevertheless, each episode page at scopesmonkeychoir.com has references and citations.
We love feedback. All right, scopesmonkeychoir@gmail.com or call the monkey phone and leave a message. 347-788-0330, which, you know, we haven't done any monkey phone messages in a while. They often sound really bad.
Have we gotten messages on the monkey phone?
Actually, we haven't gotten any in a couple weeks.
We'll call the monkey phone.
Yeah.
Someone from Finland, call the monkey phone and pronounce the name of the university and tell us about the folk tales.
Or if you,
of
oh
the
God,
aurora.
You know, it'd be so awesome if you have, you actually know a folk tale that talks about aurora sounds. Call the monkey phone and leave it for us. If you do, be prepared to call back in like 2-minute increments because it has a time limit.
Bye. Right, thanks for listening.
Yeah, see you next week.